Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
This podcast contains explicit language.
So that happened. This week, documents obtained by Fairfax Media, the Huffington Post's media partner in Australia, have exposed energy contractor Unaoil as an almost comical practitioner of corporate graft, bribing their way across the developing world on behalf of well-known Western corporations. These documents expose many companies to prosecution, but what they also reveal is the twisted nexus between corporate corruption, failed states, and global terrorism. We'll break down the story. Meanwhile, in some better news for major U.S. corporations, Georgia Governor Nathan Deal defied his party this week in vetoing a religious freedom bill that would have enshrined legal discrimination against the LGBTQ community. We have Disney and the National Football League, among others, to thank for this, proving once again that cash rules everything around us. Finally, what is it like to fall into the burning ring of fire produced by Donald Trump's legion of social media fans? Our own Christina Wilkie found out for herself firsthand and has some of the vile details to share with all of us. I'm Jason Lincolns with Huffington Post reporters Nick Bauman, Jen Bendery, Zach Carter, Arthur Delaney, and Christina Wilkie. We'll have all of that, plus a discussion of Donald Trump's bizarre thoughts on reproductive freedoms. In fact, that's what's happening first. Hello, good evening, and welcome to another edition of So That Happened, your podcast about the way we are slowly sliding into a garbage trough here in America. My name is Jason Lincolns. I am the editor of Eat the Press. I was out sick last week, and I apologize for that, but it was left in the capable hands of the two people sitting with me right now, Mr. Zach Carter.
Whew, boy, what a morning. Just getting up and getting out of this tent where I live in the studio tent. Where yep. We record this podcast.
Guys.
Yep, and
guys,
and hater of college basketball, Arthur Delaney.
You said it good evening, and he said good morning, and that really pisses me off.
We did that to troll you.
Yeah, it's not either of those. It's whatever time it is for the listener now.
We were, I think, simply trying to accommodate all listeners, right?
Yeah.
So well, that's how we did it.
Really sucks.
Apologize for that. Temporal reality is a tricky thing to measure. So a lot going on this week. We have a lot going on in this podcast today, but we're going to get started right now with some crazy shit that happened in the 2016 race, and specifically some crazy shit that happened with Donald Trump and comments about abortion. And apologies to all of our listeners. We are going to be talking about abortion and reproductive freedoms, and we're doing it in the manner of a Republican subcommittee in that we are all white men talking about it. But we're going to try to perhaps do credit to white men by speaking about this with the sort of open-mindedness and honesty that the topic deserves. So this week, Donald Trump goes on Chris Matthews' show, Hardball. And he says
nothing gendery about that. Nothing at all.
It's Chris Matthews, man. So, and he said this, which kind of lit up the world when he mentioned it.
Do you believe in punishment for abortion? Yes or no? As a principle,
The answer is that there has to be some form of punishment
for the woman.
Yeah, there has to be some form.
Ten years.
I don't know.
Wow.
Yeah, so
there should be punishment.
The first level of interest here is that Donald Trump, in suggesting that women should be punished for receiving abortions,
punished, not necessarily published.
Sorry, did I say published? Sorry, punished for actually exercising their legal rights to a legal medical procedure.
I mean, you could punish them by publishing it.
You could. Is the kind
Scarlet
of thing,
letter.
It's like the only way that you can really discuss abortion policy that angers both ardent defenders of reproductive freedoms and those who oppose reproductive freedoms. Because the pro-life community
doesn't like to follow through on the implications of
exactly.
their policy
yeah, they
positions.
Were just like, shh, don't yeah, say that.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And they do not tend to advocate the legal punishment or extra legal punishment. Well, I guess they do always count it as extra legal punishment women. But it was the kind of thing that like really just put Trump in arrears with almost everyone in the world.
It was genuinely shocking just because you never hear anyone say that except for truly
deranged.
Hardcore, deranged pro-lifers.
But yet this to me illustrates one theory I've had about Trump for a long time, which is that while people in the establishment circles and in of both parties and I think throughout most of the media are offended by his sort of brash approach to things. Brash is a very nice way to put it. He's often just saying bluntly what the actual implications of longstanding Republican policies are that are shared by other people in the Republican establishment.
Yes. Yeah, he's not using the dog whistle. Yeah. He's just barking.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the same when the stuff that he says about about Muslims, the stuff that he says about Latino immigrants. I mean, this is basically what the rest of the party has been winking and nodding at for several years.
The subtext is text with Trump in all things. Now, of course, he's walked it back because, I mean, to the extent that Donald Trump walks anything back. Donald Trump really is the kind of candidate who's like a fucking plastic bag in a parking lot. Wherever the wind is blowing him, that's where he's going.
No, I was surprised that he walked it back because his normal way of handling what would be considered a gaffe is to just deny that he said it.
Right.
No matter how many different angles it's on videotape. and so why is he like kind of being chicken and saying, oh, it was a misstatement? I was confused by that. As confused, I guess, as I was by the fact that people were upset that he'd said it, even though with pro-lifers constantly saying abortion is murder, don't you want to punish murder?
Right. So the nominal idea here is that if you oppose abortion, you want to punish abortion doctors. And out of, I guess, politesse or political correctness, the proper way of enunciating your policy preference is to call women who receive abortions a second victim of the abortion.
They have no agency. They are not capable of making decisions
exactly.
in a democracy.
But and that gets to what's really the fact is like perhaps the people who share this view don't believe women should be put in jail or stoned in the town square, but it's not like they are. It's not like they don't harbor the sentiment of punishing them.
Well, let's also point out that in the last few years, the pro-life movement has pushed in multiple states bills that would give they're called fetal personhood bills that give a fetus the full rights of an adult human being from the moment they are conceived. These bills don't make allowances for how to punish the crime of murdering a fetus, which is a person under these bills. All of the standard things that would apply in a murder case, like being an accessory, if you hired a hitman, you can still be tried for murder even if you don't pull the trigger. Those bills don't make concessions for women in those cases. So even though the pro-life movement likes to go around saying, "Oh no, we love women, we cherish women, we don't want to punish them, they're victims." The fact is they've been pushing legislation that would do just that.
And there have been a number of instances in recent years of women actually getting prosecuted for pursuing abortion because it runs afoul of whatever state law has tried to criminalize it to the extent they can under Roe v. Wade, for it have too late in the pregnancy or improper method. So it's not an unheard of thing. So it was just a little odd for people to be like kind of freaking out over the fact that Donald Trump had said this.
I also think it should be pointed out that from a sort of heuristic perspective, fetal person is pretty ironic. It still treats fetuses as an abstraction. It just allows opponents of abortion to cloak themselves in the guise of a potential child to make the case that abortion is murder. It really actually for a concept that purports to be lending agency to fetuses, it's actually stripping those fetuses of what agency they have. So it's rather consistent with everything else we're talking about.
So some people are like, now this is going to sink Trump.
Come on now.
But they're looking on long term, like his toxicity among women voters who are pro-choice will doom him. And here, this makes it all the more obvious why that is.
I mean, to my mind, I don't think this specific issue on abortion hurts him. I think the fact that he is just deeply unpopular and not well-liked basically anywhere in the country is a bigger problem. But on abortion, I mean, look, he's in a lot of ways, he's more moderate than Ted Cruz. He's more moderate than Marco Rubio. These are people who oppose abortion in all cases, no exceptions for rape or incest. You know, Trump doesn't support that, and I don't see how a Republican Party, even at the primary stage, is going to punish him for saying, I want to punish women who seek abortions.
I agree that he's more moderate on abortion, even notwithstanding what he said, sounding really extreme. But I don't think that he's, like, at all similar to the other Republicans trying to be president because of his other sort of fascist tendencies.
I think that's definitely the case, and I think that what you see in the underlying premise of what Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio believe really isn't about abortion. It's about their belief that women should not have recreational sex at all, and that women should be punished for enjoying sex. And it's a weird society to live in when the same people who believe that women are whores for enjoying sex or having sex recreationally are constantly stuffing Viagra in the mouths of men. It makes you wonder who they think these men are going to fuck once they've been enabled to do so forevermore.
They love women. They cherish women.
Yeah, yep. And women are chattel. Anyway, to them. Anyway, another great week on the campaign trail. We didn't even get to, there's so many other things. Trump said 70-some odd things in that interview that were either complete lies or wrong, and this was just one of the more, well, actually, there was another interview.
It was a new thing. We hadn't had this thing before.
Yeah.
This is why he's almost...
It was a new kind of bullshit.
This is almost why he's fact-check proof, because he throws such a welter of bullshit at you that you just don't know where to come. Anyway... We have a really great show. We're going to talk about government corruption. We're going to talk about religious freedom bills that have gone down. And you should stick around because it'll be a good time. And we're back. Hey, everybody. I don't know if you've been paying attention to Georgia, the state, not the nation, but Georgia, the state in our country. But recently, there's been a little touch of controversy. The legislature had sent Governor Nathan Deal a bill that would ostensibly assist and enable, quote, religious liberty. But really what its intention was to bring a whole passel of discriminatory practices on the LGBTQ community. There was enormous pressure against it, and this week Nathan Deal did something that I think maybe you'll find a little bit surprising if you forget that money, cash rules everything around us. Joining us to talk about this is our buddies Arthur Delaney.
Hi.
And a special guest, Jen Bendry.
Hi.
Welcome back, Jen Bendry. As is tradition, when we're talking about gay stuff, we get Jen Bendry.
I am the token lesbian employee.
I mean, we didn't ask Jen Bendry to talk about this to be a spokeswoman for lesbians.
You guys do it every time you have me on the show. It's fine.
Yeah.
But Jen,
just own it.
But Jen, you wrote a story about this this week. That was the reason, you know about...
Arthur, I was simply being arch and demonstrating this office's... well-known camaraderie and affection for one another. So with that being established, Jen, you did write a story about Nathan Deal's surprising decision in this regard. And what was that decision? Drumroll, please.
So Governor Deal vetoed the bill.
What?
And he's a Republican.
What? And a Southern Republican to boot.
Yes.
Yes. So despite the fact that this obviously... was handed to him by, you know, a constituency that probably was very, very favorably inclined toward sticking it to gay people, Deal opted to not veto it. And it seems pretty clear that the pressure was big money.
Yes. It wasn't necessarily that he felt it was the moral thing to do to not hate on gay people. Instead, it's more likely the fact that Disney vowed to pull out of the state. if this bill became law.
Disney's got, like, what, a call center in Georgia? There's no Disney World.
They have way more than a call center. Georgia has really good tax credits for the film industry. So all these big film companies go to Georgia and hang out in Atlanta and film stuff. Hmm. Disney has a hub there, and they film huge movies there. They filmed Ant-Man there last year. They filmed some kind of Captain America movie that I don't know about. They also own Marvel, so all those Marvel movies are part of Disney.
Oh, God.
They're filmed there. So just last year alone, there was something like $160 million spent on one movie there. So if Disney is saying, we're going to pull out of your state if you pass this law, that's like hundreds of millions of dollars lost for the Georgia economy on the governor's watch.
Be a big deal.
And I understand
You'd be left with Nathan. Sorry.
I understand the National Football League also made it clear that there would be no Super Bowl hosted in Atlanta if this law passed.
The NFL, yes, they said that. They strongly suggested they might pass over Atlanta for a Super Bowl site if this bill became law. And there were dozens and dozens of other businesses. It wasn't just them. Salesforce, which is a huge California-based tech company, worth billions of dollars. The CEO of that company has been out in front on these kinds of fights against anti-LGBT bills. He said that he, too, would pull out of the state, and that was, they have a hub in Atlanta. So once the money starts being threatened, there's a threat to take money out of the state in large quantities over a bill like this, you can bet that the governor is sitting there thinking, oh, my God, I'm going to kill the state's economy because of this bill. No.
How would the bill have worked?
Well, essentially, it was any taxpayer-funded organization where people worked who had a sincerely held religious belief that marriage should be between a man and a woman will not be punished by the government if they act on their belief. So, in other words, that means if I work at a state-funded foster care agency,
yeah,
and you two come in, Arthur and Jason, and you're a gay couple, and you're married, or not, you're just coming in together, and you want to have a foster child, or if I'm an adoption agency person, you want to adopt. I can tell you that I don't agree with your sexuality and your ability to get married, and I'm not going to help you adopt a kid.
Right.
And that's just one example. Think of all the taxpayer-funded entities there are where they can just do that now. There's, you know, drug counselors, foster care, like I said, adoption agencies. People like Kim Davis,
yes,
who
Kim
will
Davis.
Refuse to do your tax forms, you know, file standard regulatory forms for you because they don't agree with your ability to get married to someone of the same sex. So
this would have kept Kim Davis in her job, sitting behind that little, you know, like low wall, just saying, no, I won't help you.
Yes, and she could continue to do that. And there would be, under this law that did not become law, it would have allowed her to do that all the time with no punishment.
The we've seen this kind of like pressure applied to these sorts of bills before. In Indiana, it was once again corporate pressure that got the governor there to dial back his efforts to impose a similar RFRA law on that state. I mean, some say corporations are people, but they're clearly not saints. What is it about the corporate mindset that makes them so antithetical to LGBTQ discrimination? It's surely not because they have a soul. What's the reasoning?
Well, maybe they have a soul.
All right, we'll give them some credit for having a soul.
But the really large corporations, they have a really diverse pool of employees. So they're going to have a lot of people there who, at least a segment of their employees who are LGBT, who are looking for their corporations to stand out in front and support them as their employees. And it's become more popular to do that.
What kind of backlash is Nathan Deal going to get for this from the Republicans who are big fans of the idea?
At this point, there have been some state legislators grumbling on Twitter and how disappointed they are. And some have said, we're going to keep fighting. We're going to bring up another bill. But,
they
can't just do that.
Veto.
They don't have the votes to override his veto. And at this point, it's not really, more broadly speaking, the direction of where laws are going. There's a wave of anti-LGBT bills happening right now. But some of them are being vetoed this week in different states because it's just not where things are trending.
Yeah, it feels kind of throwback.
It is kind of throwback. And it's a response to the Supreme Court legalizing same-sex marriage last year. A lot of conservatives freaked out and said, whoa, we need to do something to push back on this crazy gay wave across the country. Let's turn to our state legislatures. There's boilerplate language in these bills. It's not like there's someone sitting in each state like, I have an idea. I'll write this bill. There's people who shop around the same bill text to different state legislatures and have them put it in their bills. And then you suddenly 25 states have the same bill.
So let's talk about a state briefly that has passed a bill. In North Carolina, they have taken similar steps to marginalize the LGBTQ community there. And I think that this law in North Carolina goes much further than anything they are attempting in Georgia. They passed a law that was ostensibly to set a groundwork for the way discrimination would be regulated and prosecuted. And they specifically left out sexual identity from consideration. And that in North Carolina had a bit further reach because it ostensibly made it possible for a landlord to throw people out of their homes or for an employer to fire someone for being gay. And that law has a little bit more stickiness than the one in Georgia did. What's being done to fight that law?
So the two main things that stand out about the North Carolina law are, one, and you're right that it is particularly terrible. It goes way further than these other bills that are popping up. The first thing is that it nullifies city ordinances that protect LGBT
people.
That's
right.
If Charlotte, which this is true, if Charlotte passed an LGBT ordinance saying, hey, people who live in Charlotte, you're protected under city ordinances, you know, against being discriminated against for being gay or LGBTQ. This law trumps all of those different town and city ordinances and said, no, those aren't in effect anymore. So there's that. So never mind the whole, you know, state, city, local argument of government. You know, that's out the window in terms of conservatives always arguing for local government. They just threw that out the window. The second thing in the bill, in the law, is that they now say that people who are transgender have to use bathrooms that match the gender that they had when they were born. So if you're transgender, that means you have switched genders, you present a different gender, and you're going to be forced in public places to use bathrooms that match a gender that you don't match anymore.
Right.
And this is the potent political, like, cheap trick where you're like, oh, people in bathrooms, it's scary.
Yeah,
like that's why this has been effective a few times.
The bathroom panic has been a thing for decades. Yeah. It's like the base issue that people like to go back to terrify people about sex and gender. And, you know, if you might
see a genital that isn't my own. Oh, no.
You don't see genitals really in the bathroom.
No, of course not. And I have never known transgender people to prey on people in bathrooms. It's, in fact, that whole line of argument is like, we're finally protecting women from being assaulted in bathrooms. I was like, no, you're not. No, you're not. Motherfucker, could Cole walk up in the bathroom right now?
Anybody can walk into a bathroom anytime. I mean,
the same lawmakers probably wouldn't care. One of the things that obviously is bad about this law is it's unconstitutional, and I believe the attorney general in that state has no plans of defending.
So that was the big news this week also, is as soon as that North Carolina law took effect, the attorney general stood up and said, I'm not going to enforce it, which is the one who's in charge of the whole thing. So now there's this really weird tension where they have a new law that the attorney for the state will not roll out.
All right. Jen and Arthur, thanks very much for being on, and we shall return momentarily.
Bye.
Bye.
Hey, guys. We'll get back to the program in just a second. I just wanted to take a minute to welcome all of you into my safe space here, to thank all of you for tuning into the show and helping us to create an Inside the Beltway show for Beltway outsiders and make it a reality. We love hearing from you. Your feedback has been such a tremendously good, positive influence on us every week. Now, you can help other people find out about this show that you're helping to build. If you are an iTunes user, please look for our show, subscribe if you haven't, and use iTunes' widgets to rate our show and to leave us a comment. It will help people like you find this show, and we can keep building what we've got going together. So head on out to iTunes, subscribe, rate, and say hello to us and your fellow listeners. Thanks so much, guys. And now, here's something else that happened. And we're back. So, government corruption. It's bad. It's really bad. And in some cases, government corruption can lead to dire impacts for the rest of the world, such as failed states, such as terrorism. Most of the time when we think about government corruption, we think about bad actors in terrible places who induced and blackmail or inveigle or deceive their way into sweetheart deals of backsheesh. But what people don't know is that sometimes there are quasi-legitimate agents that don't so much succumb to corruption as they do induce corruption. And today we have a story about one such company called Unaoil, which you may not have heard of, but are surely now going to hear a lot more about. Joining me to talk about this is our good pal, Zachary Carter.
Hey, Jason.
Hi, Zach. And Huffington Post editor of some kind. I don't know your title, actually.
Super editor.
Super editor.
Yeah, I think that's technically true.
So the Huffington Post, working with our partners in Australia, have uncovered a cache of emails implicating a company named Unaoil for essentially inducing global corruption in all sorts of dangerous backwaters. Nick, can you take us through just the basics of who Unaoil is and what they do, ostensibly?
Sure. So Unaoil is this Monaco-based company. A lot of their subsidiaries are registered in the British Virgin Islands. Those are both offshore. Well, Monaco's not offshore, but they're tax havens. And it's run by the Sani family, which is this family of wealthy millionaires and philanthropists. Sort of patriarch of this family, Atta Hassani, founded this company in 1991. He's a refugee from the Iranian Revolution, the Islamic Revolution.
And what do they purport to do?
It's kind of vague, but what he told us is that they connect with international companies with local expertise.
Yeah, Western technology and local expertise. But, I mean, you can sort of think of them as sort of like a lobbying firm. They make connections between large Western corporations and governments in some of the most, I think, corrupt and unstable regions of the world.
And they're vaguely stated they are in the energy industry.
Yeah, a lot of their clients are energy companies or companies that work in oil field services, sort of providing drills or providing people or providing all sorts of things.
Making pipelines, the construction stuff that goes along with the oil business.
Yeah. All right, well, this all sounds like stuff that typically needs to be done. I've got friends in management consultancies. What's the problem here with what Unaoil actually does?
So in these emails, there's a lot of evidence to suggest that what Unaoil is actually doing is bribing foreign officials, people who either work for governments abroad or work for state-owned entities abroad, both of which are illegal under U.S. law. That's sort of the problem.
You're talking about things like buying people clothes, buying people furniture, just paying people thousands of dollars.
Yeah, see things like Super Bowl tickets in the mix.
Yeah, I mean, but even worse, I mean, we did a piece on KBR, which is a U.S. sort of energy conglomerate, government contractor.
Kind of like Brown and Root.
Yeah.
Okay.
Used to be part of Halliburton. And, one of the people who was involved in this process was a person, a Kazakhstani official, who was just getting thousands of dollars a month deposited into a bank account. It just so happens that KBR ended up with a pretty lucrative contract and that Unaoil ends up making a lot of money based on, their ability to secure this contract for the U.S. company. So you have a chain here where everybody benefits except the people of Kazakhstan because you get inflated prices for these or what appear to be inflated prices for these contracts that are secured through bribery, not through the merit or the quality of the operation.
So these are what Unaoil essentially does is they are essentially a clearinghouse for government bribes.
It looks that way. I mean, there are an enormous amount. There's an enormous amount of evidence, particularly in Kazakhstan and also in Iraq, where it just seems like a lot of people are getting paid by Unaoil in order to get contracts for these Western corporations. And you know, they mean some of these companies like KBR have been in trouble for bribery before. I mean, KBR settled. They were convicted.
They pleaded guilty and had a deferred prosecution agreement where basically the Justice Department told them, if you are very, very good, we will not come back and punish you even more. And they agreed to pay hundreds of millions of dollars in fines, and their CEO ended up going to jail.
Just to be clear about this, when we talk about hundreds of millions of dollars in fines, what kind of dent does that put in their basic profit bottom line?
It's obviously it didn't put them out of business, but in terms of the kinds of fines that the U.S. government assesses on corporations, it's actually quite significant. There aren't really that many cases, especially with other laws, where the government is regularly assessing $100 million fines.
So this isn't like HSBC laundering money for cartels and terrorists and getting a slap on the wrist. This is actually when they get fined, they actually get fined a significant amount of money.
Well, I mean, we'll see what happens. If you know, we've presented quite a bit of evidence that that they're involved in what looks like an illegal scheme here. So if the U.S. government takes action, you know, they have a lot of options on the table, because as a result of that deferred prosecution agreement that Nick just mentioned, the company KBR has waived its rights, a lot of its rights in court, to defend itself against you know, future types of corruption cases. So the U.S. would have a very strong U.S. government would have a very strong hand if it wanted to go and take on KBR. We'll see if they actually want to do that. It's been several years since the KBR settlement or DPA, and the Obama administration hasn't been terribly aggressive with corporate fraud in the time since.
Okay, so let's say we've established the fact that this ongoing corruption is happening. Can we explain to our listeners how this now gets to terrorism?
Really, it's not a big coincidence that the countries where Unioil is operating are these sort of low level of governance, high corruption countries. Those also happen to be countries where there is often a lot of oil or other natural resources. And one of the complaints that you see consistently across this region, North Africa, the Middle East, Central Asia, is that people complain that their governments are corrupt. And corrupt governments, there's a lot of academic or research that shows this, corrupt governments or governments that are perceived to be corrupt are weak governments. They're vulnerable to insurgencies. They're vulnerable to terrorism. They're vulnerable to unrest, and we've seen that play out across certainly across the Arab world in the past few years.
Terrorists actually are happy to use government corruption as a recruiting tool. Correct? I mean, they actually will say, "What you're witnessing here in this corrupt government is bribery and graft and grifters," and that's what Western democracy is. It's bribery, it's graft and grifters. We offer a purer and more accountable form of governance. I mean, these are claims that I believe in the piece we talk about how the Taliban has literally positioned themselves as the better actor, citing this sort of corruption.
Totally, and you see this with ISIS too. ISIS actually pretty regularly executes members who it believes are participating in corruption or taking bribes. That doesn't mean, you know, to be clear, that doesn't mean that the Taliban or ISIS or any of these groups are actually pure or actually incorruptible.
No, of course. Yeah, we'll
it just means that they take advantage of the perceived corruption of their opponents. And they're very concerned because they know this is such a powerful issue for winning public support in these countries. They're very concerned with appearing to be incorruptible.
There is obviously a law, the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, that is supposed to guard against this kind of thing. What kind of exposure do the companies that have been exposed in these emails face in terms of prosecution?
It depends on how aggressive U.S. prosecutors want to be. I mean, it's pretty clear. The FCPA doesn't just bar you from, you know, taking a bag of cash, handing it to a guy at the Iraqi government and saying, give me a contract. It actually, you know, you can't work through middlemen. And it doesn't just bar you from actually paying bribes. It bars you from working with people who pay bribes if you should have known that these people were engaged in the bribery
business.
Well,
where do you get to the point where you should have known about it? Obviously, some of these practices are quite opaque. Is there a responsibility that corporations and contractors face to do some sort of due diligence? And what's the level of due diligence they should do?
I mean, a lot of that will depend on prosecutors' discretion. But you can see in a lot of these emails, somebody from, say, Halliburton or KBR will say, you know, we really need to make sure that this payment doesn't go to a bank account in a third-party country. So, you know, to some random tax haven somewhere. We actually need to make this payment in the country where this contract has been executed, because otherwise we will run afoul of the law. And it's not clear if this is the level of, you know, it's not obvious that this is the level of due diligence that a prosecutor is going to say is acceptable for a company of this size with this type of contract. But they are clearly trying to at least check a few boxes to say, look, we took these steps to make sure that we weren't running afoul of the law.
Look, so I spoke to a FCPA expert named Richard Bistrong, and he's an expert because he was actually involved in an FCPA violation, and he turned state's evidence, cooperated, served 14 months in federal prison. Now he advises companies on how to avoid this. And what he said is that there are all sorts of red flags here. The fact that Unioil is based in Monaco in the first place, the fact that it's registered in the British Virgin Islands, and even the fact that this is the oil and energy industry requires a really high level of due diligence, because a lot of the statistics that the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development has collected on corruption suggests that this is among the most, if not the most, corrupt industry with regards to bribery.
Is there a favorite example in what you've uncovered to sort of elucidate the kind of nonsense that's been going on with Unioil? Like, is there one example that rings out as more, like, I don't know, shocking or obviously ridiculous than all the others?
So I'd say a couple things. The first is that even Unioil does not always put into emails the things that it should not put into emails. In one particular case, one of Unioil's clients actually writes in an email essentially, what sort of bakshish, which is a common slang term for bribes, what sort of bakshish will we need to get this deal done? Which when I read it to FCPA experts, they were like, oh, God, I can't believe that guy wrote that. I think one of them actually said, woo, boy. And someone said, that's the stupidest thing I'd have ever heard. But in that case, one of the Sonis actually wrote back and said, I have no idea what you're talking about this. So they were pretty careful in emails. Still, you know, I guess I think one of my favorite examples is Unioil is paying this guy in Kazakhstan who's working as a consultant for the Kazakh state oil company, and he's also working for Unioil at the same time. And they end up buying furniture for his apartment, like really fancy designer furniture, and talking about that in emails. I thought that was just a great instance of how it's not always cash that these people want or are interested in. It's not the only way to influence them.
And there's, you know, it's hard to demonstrate a paper trail in the banking system with that sort of thing, right? Because there's no payment that shows up in, you know, say the books of HSBC. There's just, you know, some new furniture that gets delivered to somebody's, you know, flat right in London.
Has this story? This story is now, I think it's been published this week. Any response from the sorts of stakeholders that might go after Unioil thus far?
I think we'll have some more on that very soon. We're hoping to break some more news as the week goes on. We do know that Rolls-Royce, which is one of the companies that's implicated in this and actually sent a letter to Unioil, I believe in 2013, complaining about alleged corruption. Rolls-Royce, when we talked to them, they said, and this is something that was already publicly known, but they said again that they are being investigated for corruption, or they're cooperating with a corruption investigation. I apologize. There's definitely an ongoing investigation there.
All right. Well, the article that everyone should read is on the Huffington Post. The headline is, there's a huge new corporate corruption scandal. Here's why everyone should care. Our partners at Fairfax Media in Australia, you can find their work under the headline, The Company That Bribed the World. It's a really fascinating read, and it's a despairing read, and it is a story that should concern and alarm the sort of people who are tasked with protecting the world from corruption and from terrorism.
And stay with us on this, because earlier this week we also published a story specific to KBR's activities in Kazakhstan. We're going to have a lot of other stories coming out about individual countries, individual companies that will all be very interesting.
Yeah, right. Lots more to come.
All right, Nick and Zach, thank you very much. We will be right back. Welcome back, everybody. So if you've been following the Donald Trump campaign with any kind of regularity, you might have caught the news this week that his campaign manager, Corey Lewandowski, who was accused by a Breitbart reporter named Michelle Fields for grabbing her at a campaign event and assaulting her, was issued an arrest
arrested.
This week. Yes. And was arrested. And it's an interesting sort of situation because it's kind of these two trails of consistent thought this is what the Trump campaign has consistently produced. One, a sort of overarching veneer of menace and violence. And two, a complete unwillingness to acknowledge when true things occur, because there were eyewitness accounts and video accounts depicting this assault, which were strenuously denied up until he was arrested today. Well, those of us here at Huffington Post know about these tendencies all too well. And joining us today to talk about this is our pal Christina Wilkie.
Hi.
And our pal Arthur Delaney.
Hi.
And so this is obviously not necessarily the Corey Lewandowski story, but it's an interesting story.
And if we could actually, if you don't mind, let's take a minute to talk about Corey Lewandowski.
Okay, sure. Okay, so Cora Lewandowski.
So what was released today, which was really startling, was not only a video that shows precisely what he was doing, but it was a video that came from Trump, that came from inside Trump's club. And it was released to police, but Trump and his staff almost certainly reviewed it before they issued all these denials, before they attacked the woman, Michelle Fields, who you can clearly see. She had bruises on her arm. You can watch Lewandowski grab her and pull her down.
The video that came out on Tuesday was the first one that was really definitive, even though others sort of suggested he was near her when she was pulled aside.
Right.
But this one was like an aerial view.
It was just undeniable, and you could see the contact. And Lewandowski had called Michelle Fields delusional before on Twitter. She
accused her of being an attention seeker.
Trump himself, he brought up an allegation or a claim that she'd made about another politician a couple of years ago. She's a beautiful young woman. Politicians are politicians. It was an absolutely classic example of victim blaming. And then this afternoon, even in the face of the video, Trump again denied Lewandowski had done anything, denied that what we all were looking at was what we were all looking at.
Right. And even said that he would continue with the campaign even if convicted.
Right.
Which would be an interesting challenge, I think, for a campaign manager.
Right. And he hired Corey, a very Trumpian lawyer.
Yes.
A lovely guy named Kendall Coffey.
Former prosecutor.
Former U.S. attorney who was forced to resign in the mid-90s after biting a stripper.
Yes, I called that a brokered convention inside a champagne room.
Yeah.
So, Christina, how did you wind up in the death orbit of the Trump campaign last week?
It wasn't through Corey Lewandowski.
Thank goodness.
Yeah, that's all I'd be thankful for.
What I did was read an interview and watched a video in which two Trump surrogates, two women who go by nicknames Diamond and Silk, two women in North Carolina— They love Trump. They're two African-American women. They appear on stage with him. They go on TV and talk about him. They sat down for an interview with a neo-Nazi. Lovely guy.
So you wrote about that because that's like interesting and different.
Yes, and
it's pretty interesting and different for African Americans to be like, yo, let's pal around with some neo Nazis.
Right? I'm just trying to say, you wrote a news item that this
yes
interesting.
We're just finding common cause with a group that would
that believes in
we
white
all
genocide
live somewhere else. Yeah, believe in white genocide.
And it's also part of a consistent theme in the Trump campaign. I mean, we've seen this resurgence of the white nationalist movement. I mean, these guys who were relegated to the fringes are now getting a lot of attention. They're getting interviews with Trump's son. So this was one of these examples. And I reached out to these women and said, did you realize that this guy, is a Holocaust denier who is really worried about white genocide and believes the only Americans are white? And
this might have been breaking news to them. You may have been performing service journalism.
Well,
for
I thought I was
Diamond and Silk.
I said, "Would you like to let me know what you thought? Were you
because on the interview he wasn't saying that stuff."
What they were doing on the interview is talking about immigration and immigrants, and
right.
So he wasn't telling them his Holocaust denial stories and his racism stories, but they were all beating up on immigrants and people who are here without documents.
And so you emailed Diamond and Silk?
At their business email, and I said, have you seen any of his writings? He cites Hitler all the time and Goebbels, and, what would you like to say? I'm working on a piece.
So did Diamond and Silk respond to you?
They did, well, in a manner of speaking, they did.
And the story just says, black Donald Trump supporters got cozy with white nationalists.
Right. A headline I didn't write, but all of this, the story is just accurate as a pin.
It just describes them going on the show and his past statements and what they talked about on the show.
And how it's part of a bigger trend of white nationalists taking a bigger role in politics than they ever have in any of our experience.
Yes.
So, story
published. 100% true story.
Normal. I go home. I go to sleep. I wake up the next morning and people are tweeting and Facebook messaging me with a video that our friends Diamond and Silk have made.
We didn't know we have to now scrutinize all of you reporters because all of you may have a past.
Uh-huh.
And you were the one that sent us questions that you didn't allow us the opportunity to answer.
Right.
Well, should we say, Christina, maybe we don't know if you're part of the KKK.
We don't
know if you're a part of the skinheads.
No,
we don't know if you are a prostitute.
We don't know
if you are a drug addict.
Okay, so let me bleach my ears.
I was being called a prostitute, a drug addict, a bitch, a whore. And then all of a sudden, it wasn't just Diamond and Silk. I think their video has been viewed about 40,000 times. But it was all the people they roused. And so it began on my Twitter page.
Well, now, did people go, on your Facebook page and try to see personal photos?
And they do a big background hunt. And I'd accidentally left one photo of my six-month-old baby on there, and
so you had set your privacy settings so strangers couldn't see this.
You didn't accidentally leave a picture of your baby on Facebook. That is a thing you do on Facebook.
Sure. I accidentally made it public.
Oh, you accidentally made it public.
So you have a Facebook account that is just your personal account.
Right.
But somehow people were able to find personal photos.
I put some public things up there because I put my stories. I connect with my sisters who comment about my work and my friends. I like my friends and my family to know my work.
So it's like you're a hybrid page for yourself and for work.
Yes.
And a personal photo was publicly viewable.
Yes. And a couple of women in who knows where, Florida, Baltimore, decided that my baby wasn't wearing the right clothes. So they launched an all-out thousands of words. A three-page story about how my husband was out cheating. My baby was sitting in a dirty diaper. Social services need to be called.
What was this? Where was this story? In your inbox?
No, it was on Facebook,
yeah,
and it
right
was over and over and over. It was publicly just posting and posting, and it was a new chapter, let's say, every time.
Now, this is not Diamond and Silk at this point. This is just random
mob. These are,
yes. One of the scariest things that I've seen so far this year is that my baby happens to have blue eyes. I don't. And a couple of white supremacists have written me to say that they're very sorry my Aryan baby has to grow up with me. Which is just a new kind of insult.
You're white.
I am white, but they see me and they see other reporters as the devil. They see journalism as the lowest profession.
Did you do anything, or did this just kind of eventually subside, this wave of vitriol?
I didn't do anything. I was really torn. I still don't know what the answer is. So I was trying to think back to other times I'd seen in political life as a reporter when the debate became ugly and people were mean. And I remembered in 2009 covering the healthcare debate on Capitol Hill.
Yeah.
And there were people who spat at lawmakers. There were people who, you know, who held signs saying the zoo has an African lion and the White House has a lion African. And so I thought back and I was trying to think what is new about this cycle, what's new about this. And Donald Trump has basically made it open season by calling out reporters one by one. Reporters weren't part of the story in 2009.
So this is a pattern that other journalists, particularly conservative ones...
And women.
Yeah, this really falls
it's a lady
like
thing.
This happened to Megyn Kelly first.
Right.
But we've seen it happen. They told Michelle Fields she was crazy. And what follows when the Trump campaign or its surrogates point the cannon is a fusillade from random people who are just like Twitter vigilantes.
Right. So, and who are out to they wrote to me that they wanted my family to see this. They wanted my parents to see what a whore I am.
So did you get doxxed?
I did. And this is a new kind of assault, I feel like, in this cycle or perhaps in the last cycle as well. But the idea that a journalist should be that these folks who are so angry about other stuff, you know, there are people who feel like the economy's left them behind. There are people who
Well, explain what happened and thereby what doxing is.
What happened is that in a number of these different social fora, the people who were really angry at me would put up all of my addresses, would put up my address at work. They put up my Twitter address. They said, let's get her. Let's get this piece of shit.
So they put, like, our office.
Yes.
And they had it correct.
Yes.
About your home?
They didn't find my home. One of them found an old apartment building I used to live at. And put that up.
I think that's disconcerting enough.
It was. They're not only organized, they have a lot of time on their hands, and they want to make reporters a story. I mean, you guys are reporters. It doesn't feel right when you're the story.
It doesn't seem so much that they were trying to make you the story. They were just trying to get you to stop writing stories.
Yeah, it was like, you know, trying to get you to stop your public participation in journalism.
Right.
You know, I don't want to get totally over our skis and suggest that, like, oh, this is, you know, perhaps a universal thing. But let's ask the question, how do we imagine what a nominated Trump or, God help us all, a Trump president might be in his interactions with the public, critics, with journalists?
Let's make clear that this fits a pattern. It's happened to at least half a dozen other journalists and commentators who've criticized Trump, and you weren't even criticizing him.
No, and I wasn't. I mean, I got the, 10% of what somebody like Fox News' Megyn Kelly got.
Arthur, you and I will inevitably get our turn. In fact, we are probably earning that right now.
Jason, you're overdue. Forever. Arthur, we're definitely going to get some.
All right, so welcome to our weird, fucked up world. Thanks, Christina.
Thanks,
for
guys.
For sharing this bizarre story with us.
It feels good to talk about it.
Yeah,
good.
I know. And we will be right back. So that's what happened this week. This podcast was produced, edited, and engineered by Christine Canetta. We are always watched over by our loving angel, Caitlin Bogucki. I'm Jason Linkins, and this week we were joined by Huffington Post reporters Nick Bauman, Jen Bendry, Zach Carter, Arthur Delaney, and Christina Wilkie. So That Happened is available on iTunes at itunes.com/sothathappened. Check out the whole family of Huffington Post podcasts in the iTunes store, and while you're there, subscribe and tell your friends. If there's something you'd like to hear us talk about, send an email to sothathappened@huffingtonpost.com. Thanks to all of you for listening. We miss you already.